Hello and welcome to Consumer Choice Radio. We're broadcasting live on the Big Talker FM 106.7 in the morning every Saturday at 10. It is the 29th day in the year 2020 of February. Welcome, everybody, to the show. I'm one of your hosts, Yael Osofsky, broadcasting to you from Washington, D.C., capital of the United States of America. And on the horn with me, as always, is our great, amazing co-host, Mr. David Clement. David, how goes it?
It's going well. Another week, another show. Looking forward to chatting and looking forward to featuring some of your interviews from CPAC
this week. Exactly. So we're here at CPAC. We have the part of the Consumer Choice Center team here trying to meet and spread our message as much as possible. So I think it's going to be a very good affair. You're going to be hearing some good interviews here in the broadcast a bit later. We'll have Randall Meyer, who can tell us all about how cannabis legalization is going in the United States, and our colleague Frederick Roeder will also be on to give us some update on the coronavirus, the spread, the outrage, and what is next when it comes to this terrible virus and disease making its way around the world. I think we'll have some good comments on that. And unfortunately, our colleague Luca Bertoletti, based in Italy, is seemingly him and both Fabio are locked in because they're in Italy and they've had a huge number of coronavirus cases and about a dozen of people who've died now. It's been pretty
serious. Italy seems to be kind of ground zero for Europe right now, in terms, especially northern Italy, for some reason. It's pretty scary when you think about it. But yeah, they are holding up and staying inside and trying just to ensure that they don't get exposed and stay safe.
Yeah, it's dangerous out there, and we've got Trump earlier this week gave a press conference. He discussed it, talked about the response of the government. So yeah, we'll definitely get more on that. And we'll be talking privacy, we'll be talking cannabis legalization, and more of the coronavirus. So great stuff happening there. But for now, again, you can listen to Consumer Choice Radio live on the weekends on the Big Talker, but also on our website, consumerchoiceradio.com. You can subscribe to the podcast there. We're on Spotify, Overcast. Find our RSS feed. We're all over. So thank you to everyone who has been sharing the link, that's been sharing this with your friends and colleagues and all the rest. Very good to see. So, David, yep. I wanted to get you on the horn. Unfortunately, we're not here in D.C. together. But, you know, there's a lot of great stuff happening, some very good things and some very bad things.
Yes.
I think let's focus a little bit on obviously, energy is something that we're very passionate about at Consumer Choice Center. We believe in different choices. We should have a good amount of mobility options. And energy is front and center right now in Canada. We covered this on the show last week.
Yes.
The blockades are big, so give us a little bit of an update. What's been happening? Is there still the political crisis, still protesters, people blockading? Kind of what is happening this day and age in Canada?
Yeah, so basically building on from our conversation last week, the blockades are still happening. However, it has now become a little more clear that the federal government is going to actually intervene, and people are going to be fined or arrested, possibly for actually setting up these blockades. So it does look like there is now action from the government in terms of ensuring that they're trying to ensure that these blockades do not continue. That being said,
and just to go back to the beginning, why are these people blockading?
Yes,
why are they setting up these areas?
Very good point. Yeah, so there is an ongoing debate in regards to the expansion of pipelines. Many of these pipelines have to have Indigenous consent because they go through Indigenous communities. There's a divide within those Indigenous communities. So the elected chiefs are very often in favor of these pipeline expansions. The hereditary chiefs traditionally are not. And so there seems to be a merging of those who side with the hereditary chiefs and the environmental movement in Canada to protest any pipeline expansion by blockading rail lines. And so they've set up blockades with wood and all sorts of other things that have basically halted train traffic Obviously, that is quite dangerous. One of the more recent ones was they lit a series of tires on fire.
Wow, it's like we're in the Middle East, you know? It's like we're in the Arab Spring or something.
Yeah, it's pretty strange. And actually, what's interesting with the tire fire blockade is that the via or the CN rail, which is like a cargo rail, actually just blew right through the tires. There seems to be some irritation and some resistance on the side of the rail operators and things like that. The biggest one that I think is the most pressing and misguided for those who are protesting is they were setting up blockades. For those who don't know, Toronto is Canada's largest city. It's a huge metropolitan city. People take what is called the GO train from the areas surrounding Toronto into Toronto for work. It's hundreds of thousands of passengers. And they had actually blockaded some of the lines that carry those trains. And so there are these videos and images of people in Union Station, which is the main train station in Toronto, without an ability to get home after work.
So 20,000. That's hundreds of thousands of commuters, right? Probably even more than that.
Yeah, I think on the one day, a minimum of 20,000 commuters were interrupted, who were prevented from getting home because either entire lines were canceled, and people had to get on buses, or there were really, really long delays. And so, I mean, certainly not. I don't think that's the best strategy for winning the public over. I mean, the public already was opposed to the blockades. I think it was something like 60%. I haven't seen what the figures are now, but stopping people from being able to get home from work certainly isn't a way to get people on your side. And there's also a great irony in shutting down rail lines, which people are taking to get to work rather than drive their car, and doing so by lighting tires on fire. So for those who are doing this on behalf of the environment, there seems to be some serious cognitive dissonance there.
And it's very upsetting for normal commuters who knows, they might be very sympathetic to exactly, you know, what the demands are and what the concerns are. But yeah, you're kind of ruining the ability for me to make money for my family as well at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, that's a one-way ticket to having everyone not support your cause or even want to hear your message. So I certainly think that that will backfire in terms of those who are setting up the blockades. So it's been, I mean, it's a super, super intriguing discussion, but it's largely just divulged into people setting up these, what I would see is quite dangerous blockades, because imagine all it would take is one mistake and someone could get seriously hurt, or a train could derail. If let's say a train didn't have the advance notice of the blockade or didn't see it because of weather conditions or what have you, you could envision a scenario where a train, rather than blowing through a series of tires that are on fire, which is not as serious, but is certainly dangerous, blowing through wood and metal and debris and possibly people. So I think the sooner that we can get this resolved, the better.
Yeah, and there's definitely going to be a lot more updates there. I mean, it's making its way through the political circles as well. There's been a lot of talk there in Parliament Hill and in Ottawa about what the federal government should be doing, whether the RCMP, the kind of FBI that are there, the National Police in Canada, whether they should just be cracking the protesters down, moving their blockades. I mean, it's crazy to see. It doesn't give a lot of hope. Certainly for Canada's energy. This is huge. You know, this is something that Canada is very reliant on. A lot of people depend on that, and doesn't really look good for, what is Canada going to do now for energy exports if it can't even get any of its energy across provincial lines or even down these rail lines? I mean, this is, it's upsetting, no doubt.
Yeah, it's definitely a disaster. Wow. So hopefully it gets resolved. And there can be some sort of bipartisan approach that at least gets the trains moving through where these blockades were and having some sort of discussion on what the complaints are, what the legitimacy of the complaints are. I mean, from my perspective, I obviously can't speak to the indigenous side of that discussion because that's too far removed from myself, but I can certainly speak on the environmental side. I think those protesting pipelines from an environmental perspective are just dead wrong because the alternative is freight and by truck or by tanker, all of which have significantly higher emissions. And so it really does, for those folks who are on the environmental side, it really does expose them in terms of their perspective of really being anti-energy rather than being pro-environment, because pipelines are certainly the way in the desirable way in terms of safety and emissions to transport these natural resources. And so to see them protest in opposition to try and save the environment just seems quite silly to me and naive.
Yeah, definitely. You're listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker 106.7 FM, broadcasting out of Wilmington, North Carolina. I'm currently in Washington, D.C. We're the nation's capital here for the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC. Big deal. I think the vice president spoke earlier this week. I believe Donald Trump will be speaking later in the week.
Yep.
So I'll have more of an update next week, I think, after after I'm able to decompress from seeing
yes.
everything there. And I'll have, I think, pretty enjoyable stories. But since we had this week, there's a big deal happening just south of us in North Carolina, but also in South Carolina. We're looking at the Democratic primaries. This is a very
yes.
important primary, very big. Mm-hmm. There was a debate earlier this week. I don't have any clips to play for now, but there's definitely some choice ones. But it looks like, you know, it was Joe Biden's to carry for a long time. But I guess if we're looking at consumer choice, Michael Bloomberg is now under the gun, and it's not
yes.
for stop and frisk. There's a great article in the Wall Street Journal here. Bloomberg defends soda smoking restrictions as mayor. So essentially,
yes.
he was put on the spot about whether he's going to be Mayor Big Gulp, Mayor Nanny on a national scale. And that's a legit question.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine the Michael Bloomberg nannyism state run amok? I mean, what would that even look like?
Yeah, I mean, that for me, that just sounds like it's some dystopian Orwellian future in which, like, you're some public health official is sitting at the dinner table with you counting your calories. It's yeah, not good. So it's nice to see that he was they kind of put his feet to the fire on that. He did backtrack, not on his record, because he still adamantly supports his record, which I think is baffling. But he did say that he wouldn't necessarily push for such policies as president, which is certainly not a good enough answer for me to feel comfortable with that concept of a Michael Bloomberg presidency. But it does maybe signal some positive that if he does manage to buy his way to the end of the Democratic convention, that he may not actually be President Big Gulp. But we'll see. It's still certainly early.
President Big Gulp. Oh man, that's yeah, very interesting to see. Hopefully, we'll get some results. You know, that's happening today throughout the weekend.
Yeah.
So we'll figure out how it works for next week. But
and
man,
I can say
insane.
This: if by chance Michael Bloomberg were to win the nomination, I think everyone should just follow him along on the campaign trail, and at every stop have a 32-ounce soda in their hand as an act of civil disobedience. I think
and the straw police will be in full force. So take your big gulp with a big plastic straw.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You're listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker 106.7 FM in the morning, broadcasting out of Wilmington, North Carolina. You can also find us around the world, consumerchoiceradio.com. Thanks to the magic of RSS, our podcast is live, and you can download and listen to it wherever you are, working out in the gym, in the car, walking the dog, wherever you might be. Consumer Choice Radio is there. We talked about the coronavirus a bit earlier in the program. David and I are following this in the news, but we don't have the expertise to really cover this. So we're going to go to our colleague, Frederik Røde, who is our colleague. He's a managing director of the Consumer Choice Center. And Fred is a health economist. That's his background. That's his training. That's what he was doing across Central and Eastern Europe, looking at the best ways to improve healthcare systems, both in private and public systems. So it's better to have Fred to talk about this, about whether or not we should be panicked when it comes to the coronavirus, what is next in terms of the outbreak, the containment, and what we can do. So here's an interview we're conducting here in Washington with Fred.
Fred, we wanted to get a coronavirus update from you. David and I have caught up on some of the news and things around it, talked about President Trump's press conference. It seems as if now this is taking the financial world by storm, definitely taking the health media world by storm. So give us an update. What's really happening? What should be, you know, what's next?
Yes, great to be on your show, Yael. First of all, I would say, please do not panic. It's definitely an unfortunate development that we have to face this new virus, the coronavirus, or nCoV-2019. But at the same time, we kind of need to also look at the facts and what's currently happening. So right now, there are over 80,000 people being infected by the coronavirus. And the initially reported mortality rate, like the percentage of people actually dying of this virus, is still somewhere around 1.5 to 2%, maybe even a bit above 2%. But especially looking at which countries are affected and how they're affected, it shows a very different picture. So if you look at China, you have an average death rate of maybe 2.5%, if we can believe what the Chinese government, the communist government, is reporting to us. And then looking at Iran, which got hit really hard, I believe even the deputy prime minister got the coronavirus, and the deputy health minister and the Iranian ambassador to the Vatican.
Doesn't look good for the deputies, right?
I mean, it's sad. But in Iran, the death rate is something around 10% or 11%, so they must manage this entire situation terrible, or they just do not report a lot of other cases. And then Korea and Japan, which are also hit fairly strong, there are hundreds to thousands of cases in both countries, their death rate is somewhere 0.1%, 0.2%. That's actually the unfortunate mortality rate also of a normal flu. And most people in these countries who unfortunately die from the coronavirus are old, they're in their 80s, or they had other lung diseases or immune system problems beforehand. So if you're young and healthy, you shouldn't be too much worried about the coronavirus.
So why is there such a difference between the health systems, and why are your chances higher in a place like Japan from something like Iran? What's the big difference?
Probably the initial response to this problem and crisis by just having governments that actually talk to their people and don't try to cover up something. Because we can definitely see a correlation between authoritarian governments and how the situation goes out of hand. But also there's the level of care. You know, in Japan and Korea, also in the United States or Germany, you have actually access to really good medicine and private doctors who just are much more competent than some regime doctors in China or Iran.
Definitely.
But I think it's even more important to think, you know, now we have many trade shows are being canceled and there are travel restrictions and a lot of goods from, for instance, China do not make it to Europe or the US anymore. And we might actually have an invisible graveyard of people dying because of all the hysteria and disruption caused by this coronavirus. So, I mean, we don't have numbers and stats on how many people might die in the next couple of weeks because they don't get drugs for another disease they have. Or they don't get that artificial heart valve, which might be produced somewhere in China and has to be implanted at Johns Hopkins University, for instance. So we might cause much more disruption and much more suffer and create so many unintended consequences because people stop trading, they stop traveling, they stop trade shows. I think a lot of innovation, probably inventions get delayed. And we should be concerned about this. I mean, you see at the stock markets, you know, recently just bought some hand sanitizer at an airport. And this guy asked me if I do stocks. And I was like, why do you ask? He's like, oh, yeah, I just lost thousands of dollars because the Dow Jones kind of collapsed. I'm like, yeah, I mean, this is hysteria, which probably causes much more problems. And we kind of need to look at this all a bit level-headed. it looks that more and more people will get the coronavirus. That's definitely not good. But also every year, like millions of people get the ordinary flu. And unfortunately, some people die of it. But if we would shut down every year, like global trade and travel and commerce, we would like basically bump ourselves back to Stone Age. And then probably we're like, you know, we won't get the coronavirus, but we die at age 30 of something different because we can just not treat anything anymore.
And your background is as a health economist, so you look at, you know, not just the dollars and cents of the best health systems and what they can implement, but, you know, the intersection between governments and spending and health. And this has to be not looking good for the big health organizations that also deal with this or supposed to be the ones that are in charge of this mess, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm like a low tax, limited government person, but I would say if government has one role is to protect us from global pandemics, such as the coronavirus. And unfortunately, the World Health Organization has been doing like a terrible job on this. They've been praising China over and over again, instead of like also criticizing, like, you know, I mean, doctors got locked away because they started talking about the coronavirus early on. The government lied and said it's under control and there are no new infections anymore. I believe that was around Christmas time. And the WHO, the World Health Organization, has just been like basically complicit with the Chinese government instead of actually calling them out and showing what's wrong there.
We saw there was the People's Daily or the China Daily. It's sort of their propaganda newspaper that you see around newsstands in places like D.C. You know, it said their top story, China praised for coronavirus response.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you can praise them. I mean, catastrophic how they dealt with this, especially intimidating doctors and civil society for talking about it. I believe the Wall Street Journal, like three of the journalists got like expelled from China because they criticized the Chinese government and their crisis response. And in open society, you know, you can actually have a debate on how to respond to something, and these responses are usually better.
Yeah, and this is Black Swan. You know, nobody anticipated this. You know, we heard the early reports, and a lot of it is focused on people who might have the disease in particular rural areas, and then they built this hospital. What was it, in like 6 days? And now it's become more, how are people connected? People are traveling. I think you saw that as well. When we entered customs, they asked you one question. You been to China in the last 2 weeks? And that was it. So if I had said yes, do I go immediately to screening? Do I get searched? Do they swab my mouth? I mean, what really, if we look at the role of governments and what they'll be doing at the borders, what are they kind of doing to people? Are they checking temperatures? I mean, what is the procedure that they have to stop the spread of the virus?
Right. I mean, there are different things happening, but to be honest, you cannot really stop it unless you really shut down all travel and all borders, which I think is concerning. Given what I said earlier, that we might just like cause so many unintended consequences from people suffering because they don't get the drugs and medicines they need for their much more common diseases. But I would also say if you live in the US, you should not be too worried. I mean, you have one of the best health systems in the world. I mean, I even remember when the Ebola virus happened, like in 2014, there were a couple of Americans, I think there were 8 workers who got infected while trying to help people in West Africa. And most of them, I believe, were being flown back to the U.S. and cured, because the U.S. is just a fantastic health system, and we've already seen that there are like private pharmaceutical companies in the U.S. who are like working on a treatment and a vaccine, and that's just after like less than 3 months of actually knowing this disease exists, which is like has been like never been seen before, that like the private sector so quickly finds like, or getting close to find solutions to these problems. So I would say just don't panic. The only thing I'm currently worried about is that I'm, while traveling, get like locked down somewhere because people, like local authorities and governments, start overreacting.
Yeah, we're already seeing that a lot. I mean, we talked earlier in the program about our colleague Luca Bertoletti and Fabio Fernandez as well, who they might get locked into Italy and not able to travel if we have conferences or meetings they have to make, or they have to go to the European Parliament in Brussels. They might be locked out. That sounds pretty bad.
Oh, it's even worse. Like, I heard that even some members of the parliament from northern Italy are not allowed to enter the parliament anymore, which is kind of like, I mean, you wonder if that's maybe even a political game of some like more southern Italian politicians who kind of want to like get a majority for some vote while they quarantine like some members from the north. I mean, that's extremely anti-democratic. And I mean, being like stripped away of your rights to kind of move freely, I mean, maybe there might be some occasions where this makes sense, but the coronavirus is not severe enough that you can actually justify this, because then we can basically do it every year for like every flu, which we kind of, we have, you know, flu seasons like November till March. So, and I mean, that's not happening. It's just currently that everyone is freaking out and they should be a bit more relaxed about the situation. At the same time, you know, you have to take the virus serious. It's a virus. It can kill people. That's not good. We probably soon will have actually a treatment for this and a vaccine. But even if you get the coronavirus and you live in a rich country like the U.S. or Japan, the likelihood that you actually die of it is really low. I mean, 80% of the cases do not even get severe symptoms.
Wow. Well, at least some positive news. Fred, thanks so much. Fred Roeder is Managing Director of the Consumer Choice Center, health economist by background. Thanks for breaking it all down, Fred.
Yeah, great pleasure. Let's just not panic.
And once more, you're listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker 106.7 FM, broadcasting every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. out of Wilmington, North Carolina. Next guest is someone who I'm very excited to have on, one of the most brilliant legal minds that I've ever had the pleasure of coming into contact with, really understands the nuts and bolts of so many things. We're talking to Randall Meyer. Randall is an executive director at the Global Alliance for Cannabis Commerce. He is a lawyer, very, very brilliant legal mind, as I mentioned. He has a lot of extensive experience being on the Hill, understands the workings of the Senate, and understands a lot more of these bills and where they stand on specifically cannabis legalization, decriminalization, and all positive movements across the entire United States. So let's check in with Randall. Amazing, amazing interview. You guys will love this.
So Randall, thanks for coming on the program.
Happy to be here, man.
So we are. There's a lot of movement that's going on around the country. There's a lot of bills regarding cannabis. Some things that are very exciting, some things that are very worrying. Sort of what are you most excited about when it comes to the cannabis space, and whether it be public policy or activism, sort of what is the next step, you think?
So the best thing that there is to think about right now is that we've had more progress on cannabis reform in the last Congress than we have had in 87 years federally. The Safe Banking Act passed the House in October with a 321 vote, bipartisan, overwhelmingly. The MORE Act is advanced out of Judiciary Committee, and several committees have actually waived jurisdiction just to expedite the passage to the floor for that bill. That's a bill that would entirely deschedule cannabis from the Controlled Substances Act and defer back to state Controlled Substances Act schemes. Each of the 50 states actually has a Controlled Substances Act. So when the federal government deschedules cannabis, it defers back to those. So there's the year we've had has been incredible, and there's still a lot of work to be done on the Senate side with safe banking, trying to get final passage of that. But there have been very positive indications. Chairman Crapo has been very engaging in the process, and he's been carefully been building support in the Senate to give that bill the exact set of conditions it needs for the best chance in the Senate. And it's very positive. This has been a very good Congress.
Has there been a kind of partisan divide into how they approach it? Are you seeing that it's particular, let's say it's more senators from states where it's already legal that you see like coalitions building, or what's it looking across parties?
It's actually surprising. The number of senators who don't necessarily have consistent federal positions with where their state's laws are at. And that's not always unexpected, you know, in certain issue areas, federal members differ from where their states are at, and that occurs occasionally. And this is, it just happens to be kind of prominent in this area. The differentiation between the two approaches seems to be that Democrats have moved towards having a social equity-based model that deschedules cannabis entirely, so it defers totally back to the states, and has public health and federal regulations, so there's interstate and international commerce. In what is frankly a major cash crop for agricultural growers and a major boon for manufacturers in the United States.
And I think speaking about decriminalization, I mean, that was kind of brought to the light with candidate Pete Buttigieg, where he talked about decriminalizing all drugs and had a lot of pushback, because I think a lot of people are, I think we don't really have a good definition of what does it mean to decriminalize versus legalize. You know, what do you have in a kind of quasi-legal state that you would have in, let's say, California and Oregon versus the federal model? You know, is
should we just put all of our eggs on the legalization basket as much as we can? Because I don't know what the timing is going to be, right? Is this months out? Is it a year-long thing? Or is this, you know, once the election is over, lame duck period? Who knows?
It's going to be a process to get to federal legalization. There's a lot of debate going on around the public health of cannabis right now. And, you know, it's very clear that cannabis in an environment where it's regulated and safe is far better for public health than it is to have it in an environment where it's criminalized and where purity testing at best would be done by someone with a criminal background. But decriminalization isn't really the most opportune thing the federal government can do. It benefits the illicit market, and it benefits those operators who would be moving. So, for example, the black market is the largest interstate trader in cannabis right now. The black market has certain facilities that are, you know, built up to specification that can be easily changed or mobile. There's not a heavy infrastructure investment because of the threat of law enforcement. You don't want to put too much into a property that's going to get forfeited. So the black market operators do that, put out as much product as possible without paying attention to public health and safety, and ship that all over the United States. The licensed businesses, by contrast, you know, the people I represent, have followed the law where you cannot cross state lines with your product. You can't engage into the interstate commerce. You have to follow the state purity laws, the state safety laws, and you have to sell to, you know, individuals who are 21 or older, or those who have a medical card with a medical exception. It's clear that with the experience of the states has made very clear that the latter model is preferable to the former model. And if we simply decriminalize cannabis, it doesn't change from the former model.
You need to have the markets. That's important to have.
Correct, because we need to have that environment where the regulations are clear to encourage investment, to encourage capitalization in the industry, and to encourage, frankly, trade relations with Canada and the other legalizing nations in Europe.
Yeah. And do you see that, you know, you've kind of been dealing with this issue a while, you have, you know, significant legal experience and understand a bit more what happens on Capitol Hill than probably a lot of people. You know, is there a sort of an acceptance that this is a legitimate market? That this is actually something that you can buy stocks in, that you can have set up in your local community? Where do you see the kind of battle for normalizing cannabis in our kind of everyday lives?
Increasingly so. It's, for example, there's, if you look at the Senate banking hearing that occurred last year regarding, you know, just the banking issues generally, not necessarily the Safe Banking Act, there was almost no Republican opposition to legalization. Virtually no one in any party wants to take that stance. I think one Democrat voted against the Safe Banking Act in the House out of the entire caucus. So it's becoming, no one wants to take an anti-cannabis stance because it's just associated with, you know, a less informed view of public health policy than has occurred in the last 20 years with the knowledge of harm reduction and the knowledge of what cannabis is as a substance vis-a-vis medical, vis-a-vis safety of adult use. So that is increasing. It is coming along. Congress has a way to go with a number of members. It hasn't been at the top of the pile for a while, but there's a reason that members are calling hearings, having these kinds of inquisitions. And we'd say that the members have just been increasingly trying to get information, increasingly trying to understand how their positions should evolve or should stay the same in the light of how the states have acted and how their various schemes work. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be an ongoing process.
And you've met with a lot of people on the Hill. Are there people who meet with you and say, you know what, we're all in, we agree, I just can't sell this back home? Do you kind of see that where they accept the arguments on the premise of it, but in terms of what they can actually bring back home and talk about in their district, or maybe they're facing some kind of primary challenge, they're like, there's no way I can bring this up in any way back home?
Not to be specific, yes, that feedback has been heard. Yeah.
Yeah, I can probably see that it's very tough to kind of balance that, and, you know, it's the inside Washington game versus, you know, trying to play to the home crowd.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing because you have people who grew up in a country where we very clearly, you know, demonized this intoxicant and this medicine. You know, since the 1970s with the Schedule I status with President Nixon, and indeed in the 1930s with the Reefer Madness campaign and the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. It's There's an education aspect to this, and the largest increasing group for using cannabis in the United States, I think there's a 75% increase in the last 2 years, is baby boomers and senior citizens. It is the over 65 in the crowd that is most using this because it is having incredible medical effects.
I have family members that have tried medical cannabis, elderly family members that have tried medical cannabis and had incredible relief for arthritis pain that they just haven't had with other medications.
Yeah.
And not that my personal experience is scientific evidence, but there's significant scientific evidence.
It helps, yeah. And one thing that has been recently discussed really ad nauseum for the last couple of months was the vaping crisis. We've covered that a lot on this program and kind of broken that down, and we know how false the premises have been from the very beginning, but how has that harmed sort of the push for legalizing and normalizing cannabis across the country?
Well, it's drawn a lot of attention to one of the larger inconsistencies when you have this state-by-state network, which is consistent purity and testing standards. As we know, the vast, vast, vast majority of where these cases originated from involved illicit cartridges for THC, some combination of THC and something else products. But the vast, vast, vast majority is coming from areas where you either have a heavy illicit market still because the legal market hasn't fully overtaken its stance, and then you have these areas where you have low access to medicine, such as Louisiana, where patients aren't really served very very heavily through the medical program, where they're still buying those illicit cartridges. So our organizations launched private voluntary standardization for our members. We've had a number of significant brands pledge their adoption of our standard, and we're taking nominations to a standards committee to try to create some uniformity across state lines. Because there's some states that do great testing standards. A lot of the state regulators have been wonderful in responding and working with CDC and FDA and trying to identify adulterants that should be taken out of these cartridges and prohibited in the legal market for the states that didn't already have those kinds of purity standards. And taking that to a uniform level across all 33 states where you have medical cannabis, that's what we're trying to accomplish next, to build back that consumer confidence issue that, frankly, the illicit market largely took away.
And is there a kind of push to think about what the laws are going to be for advertising, for branding, for being able to put this out on billboards? I mean, we have that in legal states now, but is there thought, perhaps in your work or with meetings that we have, or people coming up with ideas? Are there models from various states that are very good models, or those that are just atrocious and that we should never follow?
Well, what we've been looking at is the model that the Tax and Trade Bureau works with alcohol, and the federal agencies work with alcohol for the 21 age limit. That's been largely effective looking at the rates of underage alcohol use over the last 10 years. So, for example, in our model legislation, what we would like to have adopted by the federal government in an ideal land where they vote our model bill tomorrow, we apply the Tax and Trade Bureau alcohol advertising regulations to the cannabis industry, because we don't want this in the hands of people who are under 21 as an adult use substance. Now, don't get me wrong, if a doctor says that this is the right thing to use and prescribes someone who's under 21 the age of cannabis, then, you know, that's between a doctor and a patient. When it comes to adult use or free use, we have to make sure we're advertising and orienting towards adults.
Yeah.
And that is important.
And with, everyone is, I think it's becoming normalized a lot through the CBD market. I think everyone kind of has one in their hometown now. They have some CBD shop, you know, that obviously liberally uses the leaf in their advertisements and their pamphlets and stuff. You know, how is that growth of this, kind of wild west of CBD shops? You know, what is that kind of doing for the perception of cannabis? Is it perhaps harming in some instances, or do you think it's only helping to change the mind of the kind of collective consciousness in the U.S.?
To a certain degree, the more something's present, the more normal it is in society. Mm. So that's just an effect. But we do have difficulty with that industry in particular because of the lack of regulation. Under the Food, Drugs, and Cosmetics Act, the federal law governing all drugs, foods, and makeup, tinctures, lotions, and that sort of stuff, there's only one legal form of CBD, Epidiolex, the approved drug that the FDA has put out for epileptic children. Everything else is adulterated Epidiolex in interstate commerce. So there's the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act rules that deal with that. So within that structure, that's way too restrictive for what actually exists in the marketplace, because there are valid CBD supplements, dietary supplements, or products that operate as dietary supplements right now that are out there in the marketplace that, you know, a lot of patients rely on regularly. But there's also a ton of snake oil.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah, I don't want to mince words remotely about that. There is just some straight snake oil.
I think people see that at the gas station and roll up. They have like these small little bottles and canisters, and it's sort of like, this product contains hemp.
Yeah.
And then most people assume that's CBD, but obviously not, and who knows what's in there actually.
Yeah, it could just be a lot of THC.
Wow, yeah.
Some of those products test positive for high THC concentrations as well, which it operates as an analgesic, so if you're using it for an analgesic purpose, you couldn't necessarily tell. Some also have been tested high for heavy metals and pesticide issues, and that comes with the illicit market, the lack of regulation, the extraction process.
Mm-hmm.
That's what was creating that class of product. It's a big issue because when you talk about the legal cannabis space, there's a lot. It's very strict. The states tend to be very strict in how it's regulated. So it stands in contrast to the CBD markets because of how the hemp legalizations work through.
Yeah. So in closing, sort of what is sort of the main focus for your organization now? What are you guys putting all of your chips in? Is it in trying to get some of these model bills passed? Is it just with sitting down with people to get the votes over the line? What is your focus going for the next couple of months?
Primary focus is passing safe banking in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
That's immediate relief for consumers, employees, and businesses. It's not just businesses that have difficulty with bank accounts and finances as a result. It's also the employees of said businesses who have those same kinds of issues. So it's something we need to get done. The public safety risk of having this much cash on hand, especially again for employees, it's unnecessary and something that the federal government can easily resolve by passing the Safe Banking Act, as Senator Crapo's doing in good faith and doing a good job trying to build consensus towards. We're also working on supporting the MORE Act and descheduling bills generally. It's important to be discussing how that allows for better public safety regulation than lesser measures or half measures we're dealing with through the appropriations.
Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker, 106.7 FM. We've been speaking with Randall Meyer of the Global Alliance for Cannabis Commerce. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Since coronavirus is in the news and we've heard a lot about the response from the global international organizations, the large ones that have a lot of the power and have a lot of the research, have a lot of medical doctors, researchers, very sophisticated nonprofit governmental employees who are active all over the world, I think it'd be a good time to play some of these clips from a couple of recent media hits and also a few videos. And the first one I'd like to play is a video that we were able to put together and publish this time last year. And this revolves around everything with the World Health Organization. We give a little bit of background as to what the World Health Organization has been up to. There's been a lot of criticism of the World Health Organization thus far. I think now it's become mainstream, but Consumer Choice Center has been talking about this for a while. So let's play a little clip, give you a little bit of background on the World Health Organization, its role in some of these crises, epidemics, and why they're actually wasting more of their time trying to keep that vape device out of your hand than they are in trying to stop these pandemics that are currently freaking a lot of people out over the world.
What would you say if I told you there was a group out there praising dictators, calling for restrictions on affordable food, opposing life-saving technologies for smokers, and doing all of this with your tax dollars? You'd want their funding cut, right? Well, the World Health Organization, or WHO, does all of these terrible things, and they do it with your money. As an example, during the 2013-14 Ebola crisis, it took the WHO months to do anything about the outbreak because they didn't want to upset some West African dictators. Instead, they chose to focus on campaigns against unhealthy lifestyles. Many people died, the Ebola virus spread, and the WHO did nothing. And when they're not trying to avoid upsetting dictators, the WHO is actively trying to schmooze them. Just like when the WHO director, General Tedros Adhanom, named Zimbabwe's longtime dictator, Robert Mugabe, a goodwill ambassador of the WHO. Only a massive public backlash made him reverse that decision. Finally, the WHO spends $200 million a year on travel. That's $28,500 per staff member, or the per capita GDP of developed countries like Spain or Italy. And it's coming out of our pocket. In comparison, effective non-profit organisations like Doctors Without Borders spend merely a tenth per staff member. It's time to cut the funds of the WHO and allow real and effective medical organisations to take the lead.
And you can find more of those videos on consumerchoiceradio.com. We've got a lot of those that revolve around the World Health Organization, some of the more problematic aspects. This is the organization that's supposed to be fighting a lot of these pandemics, but really they've been fighting those people who like their vapes. They're trying to quit smoking or trying to use alternatives. These are great innovative technologies that have been created by the market, and the WHO is doing everything they can to try to stop it. So this is very interesting things when it comes to the coronavirus being in the news. And speaking of that, one of our colleagues, Jeff Steyer, he's one of our senior fellows based out of New York. He was able to be a guest on the Fox News program Tucker Carlson Tonight. This is one of the most watched television programs in the country. And we're very lucky that we have had senior fellow Jeff Steyer, who's able to stop by, who gave a lot of background on the World Health Organization, some of the problematic aspects with the leadership, their funding, and really where they've been busy. And I think this is also kind of some very good background if you want to understand more about, you know, these very international organizations. They're not essentially clear or transparent. There's a lot of very confusing things that happen there, a lot of funding from various governments, a good portion by the United States. So this is Jeff Steyer, our colleague on Fox News' Tucker Carlson Tonight.
This is the organization the world is looking to for guidance as it battles a pandemic that could kill millions of people. Jeff Steyer is a senior fellow at the Taxpayer Protection Alliance. He's covered corruption at WHO for years. He joins us tonight. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on.
Good to be with you.
So how did this man, who seems not just unqualified, but seems to have the kind of background that would make him exactly the wrong person to run the World Health Organization, how did he get this job?
Well, that's right. Even though U.S. taxpayers cover about almost half the bill for the WHO, a $2 billion a year WHO budget, we have very little say over what they do, and they have elections. Different countries have voted to support Mugabe. There's been a corruption at the WHO before Mugabe, but people like myself were sounding the alarm bells to have a Marxist. I mean, this guy was a number three official in a Marxist regime of Ethiopia. And as you pointed out, he went on to appoint Robert Mugabe, of all people, to be a goodwill ambassador. This is a culture of corruption at the WHO that goes beyond Tedros. It goes beyond the prior director general. It's part of the culture. This was not—you pointed out the $200 million a year they spend on first-class air travel and hotels. That's more than they spend on AIDS, tuberculosis, and other diseases combined. And there's no oversight. There was a criticism of that 5 years ago. The Associated Press did a report just in 2017 and found that it was happening again. And Dr. Tedros, his primary goal is socialized health care all over the world. That's his goal. We need to have faith in our public health institutions. But right now, the World Health Organization needs oversight. It has shown us time and again it's not going to reform itself. And we, U.S. taxpayers who are funding this corruption, need to do a better job of putting in some oversight.
I mean, that's a shocking story, but it goes from annoying, kind of head-shaking, to really a peril to our country in the middle of a rising epidemic. So a guy who denied the existence, who tried to cover up the existence of an epidemic, is coordinating the world's response to this epidemic, a threatening one. does this have implications?
I mean, it does. It does. Well, as you pointed out, he has been praising China. Dr. Tedros has been praising China for transparency. That's like Lance Armstrong crediting the Houston Astros for having good sportsmanship. It's totally absurd. Now, I have called for the U.S. to cut back funding for the WHO, and the president has put that in his budget. And now, people like the Mailman School of Public Health professor, Chelsea Clinton, are saying that this potential outbreak is Trump's fault. Right? We need oversight of the WHO. We need to reform it, but we need to do so. We need to give it money with strings attached, because it's times like this that we need to have an institution that the public can trust. And the WHO doesn't deserve it, and they haven't earned it, and we shouldn't be funding it at the same levels.
So we're almost out of time, Jeff, but did you just say Chelsea Clinton is a public health professor?
At the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. She had a piece on CNN.com just yesterday blaming this administration for not being prepared. The problem is
I thought she worked at a hedge fund or was a documentary filmmaker. I didn't know she even had a job. How'd she wind up as a public health? I mean, how low are the standards?
Well, it is the Columbia School of Public Health here in Manhattan. So it's pretty troubling. And, you know, she got her piece placed on CNN.com. So at least she has an outlet. But the WHO doesn't want to hear from its critics.
No, obviously not. But higher education in this country is a joke. And unfortunately, that can have really bad consequences. I hope we're not going to see them now. Jeff, great to see you. Thank you.
Good to see you.
It's a strange world out there.
You are listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker 106.7 FM in the morning every week, Saturdays at 10. You can go to consumerchoiceradio.com for some of the show notes, some of the videos, and links to all of those. So you'll find plenty there. I'm broadcasting from Washington, D.C. today. David is our colleague, and, you know, he's been following the news in Toronto. We heard a lot about the blockades earlier, but figured now would be a very good opportunity to hit up some of the media hits from our Consumer Choice Center colleagues. I've got some great, interesting articles and media hits. My favorite is likely Lonely Planet. Lonely Planet, very well known. If any of you have traveled, been around, you've maybe seen a lot of tourists that will have these nice blue books that have the picture of a city or a country on there. And it is a very popular item, certainly amongst people who like to travel to Asian countries. You definitely see this in different parts of Europe. Lonely Planet are these travel guidebooks, and they have on their website the Consumer Choice Center Railway Station Index. We talked about that in the last program. That is the railway index in which we ranked all of the top railway stations in Europe by basically how convenient they are for consumers. When it comes to traffic, when it comes to the ability to find bars and restaurants, any type of food, great travel options, you know, ability to find the right station, the ability to have international train connections. The index is, again, blowing up. We talked about that last week. But the Lonely Planet hit, that is amazing. Another hit that we have here is from The Telegraph. So huge in the United Kingdom as well. Obviously, the winner was the London St. Pancras station. So there's been a lot of great media coverage on that. And I got to say, it's one of the funner projects. You know, if there's some type of index you think that would be very popular in the United States or wherever else, you can always write to us, hello@consumerchoiceradio.com. Always willing and very happy to hear your ideas about everything that is going on there. So we're coming into the last couple of minutes of the program. I figured now would be a very good time to also look at some of the big news, consumer issues that are happening. This is an article from the Wall Street Journal. New York businesses anticipate the plastic bag ban. The plastic bag ban was passed a while ago. I believe that was in April by the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo. And basically, it'll be this weekend on Sunday that they're going to have this in effect for the very first time. You will not be allowed to use any type of single-use plastic bags. This is another sort of regulation that's put into place because they want to try to protect the environment. Does it actually protect the environment? Will it do enough to really change the measurement of the earth in terms of what the activists are asking for? Not at all.
Not at all, probably not, and definitely not going to see a big change. But it will upset a lot of people or have to move to paper. There's a lot of studies that have been done on the paper bags versus the plastic bags. The paper bags obviously take a lot more space up in a lot of landfills, and that has been very problematic in cities like Baltimore, where they have these landfills that are now getting filled up with even more paper products, which do break down in shorter amount of time, but they still do take much more physical space, whereas a lot of plastic items, if they're able to melt them down, they're able to transform them, or even if they have plastic bags, they're able to get rid of them in the landfill a bit easier. Also, the piece of evidence that we know, there's a study done about these canvas bags that now they recommend people use. I mean, I use these as well just because they're sturdy and nice and great, but at the same time, you can pick up a single-use bag if you need it, whether it be plastic or paper. The canvas bags, as we know, really have to be reused thousands of times before you're really going to get the same amount of impact that you would have with a plastic bag. So something interesting from New York. Again, there's many parts of this show that we could just broadcast all about New York. We could broadcast all about California. And we could broadcast about basically all the big consumer issues that come out of there, especially with these large states that have a lot of population. I mean, where this show is being broadcast out of in North Carolina, we've tended to avoid many of these consumer bans. We did not have this with vaping. I haven't had it too much with plastic bags and these kind of things. Of course, it's voluntary in other places, like in North Carolina. If you want to choose to not use the plastic bags, hey, it is well within your right. You have options, and you can choose. That is the entire aspect of consumer choice. That's the kind of stuff we fight for. That's the kind of stuff that at least gets our wheels and our gears grinding. And we hope you join us. Hope you keep listening. I hope you enjoy the program. If you like us, please do go on over to our Facebook page, our Twitter page, Consumer Choice Center, fairly easy to find. You can find us there, follow us, share a lot of our materials. We'll be able to use a lot of this for the radio show next week and going forward. There's a lot of inspiration that we can get from many of you who've already written to us. You've been very vociferous and agreeing with some parts of the show or disagreeing with many parts of the show, but we love the conversation, the back and forth. It's important that we promote these ideas together, and I think we can definitely have an impact with so many of you. So continue to listen in, consumerchoiceradio.com. We're broadcasting from CPAC in Washington, D.C. We're going to have many more stories for you next week. Hopefully things will not get too rowdy, but definitely a lot of great things to learn. It's been great to have you on. I'll say goodbye for David, but to the rest of you, au revoir. We'll see you next time here on Consumer Choice Radio. Until then.